Next, Cuba. Obama's visit to that country, with which the U.S. has been effectively at war for over 50 years, introduces a new tone for U.S.-Cuban relations. The long-standing embargo has sealed off Cuba from American eyes. Most of us know little about life there except crude caricature. Rachel Price's book, Planet Cuba, there's a slash between those two words that you can't hear on the radio, looks at the country's culture, notably visual arts and literature, in relation to both internal Cuban life and to the outside world. It was published late last year by Verso. Rachel Price is an associate professor at Princeton, specializing in Latin American culture. Rachel Price. Obama in Cuba, really quite an extraordinary event. What are your impressions of the visit? What did it feel like to someone who knows Cuba and knows America? What did you see to see these things coming together?
I think it is a momentous visit, and I actually thought it was really a remarkable speech that he gave today. Yesterday, Obama and Raul both gave a joint press conference, which was notable just because it hasn't been done before. But I thought the speech today was particularly significant because of some of the topics that Obama touched on. He mentioned the sort of shared history of slavery between Cuba and the U.S. and challenges having to do with racial discrimination in both places. He asked the U.S. to end the embargo. He pushed Cuba on questions of human rights, but he also reiterated that any change that happens in Cuba comes from Cuba and that the U.S. is not there to impose anything. And he also, something that really struck me is he recognized the need for reconciliation between Cuban Americans and Cubans, and that's something that hasn't been as big a part of the conversation at this level so far.
Now, of course, this is reckless generalizations, but what are your understandings of how Cubans feel towards the United States? We've been had an embargo on the country for 5 decades. It's been pretty hellish in a lot of ways because of the embargo, but there also seems to be a lot of connection and fascination. How did you characterize that?
It's part of a really long-standing relationship that predates, of course, the revolution and the embargo, and so I think there have been ongoing ties. I always think of the two countries as sort of co-productions of one another. So sometimes people today are afraid of the invasion of Americans. I've heard this a lot when I'm talking about my book, and I say
commercial, not Bay of Pigs style. Right,
right, exactly. Cruise ships, which actually have just gotten clearance. But I think, there's this long relationship that really, there was never any isolation in terms of cultural exchanges, in terms of shared cultural interests. Another thing to keep in mind is that since the revolution, there have been Cubans living here in the U.S., so there's always been exchanges between Cuban Americans and Cubans. So what are the feelings by many Cubans towards the U.S.? I think it's mixed, as you can expect, but I think there's a lot of warmth or a sense of proximity in terms of a shared history.
You capture this in your book's title, Planet/Cuba. It's a small country, of course, but of enormous global influence. After Jeffrey Goldberg made his visit to Cuba last year with someone for the Council on Foreign Relations, Julia Zweig, I listened in on a press conference that they gave, a phone press conference. And Goldberg, who was not the most progressive person politically, remarked on what an enormous figure Castro was and how he had just been such a world historical figure for 50 years and really, had captured the world's attention. This small country.
Right.
How did that happen? I mean, it is just a little island off the United States. Why does it have this kind of global impact?
And actually, just to add there, that's something I appreciated again in Obama's speech today, is he also recognized that world historical importance. He said Cuba is an island nation, but it's also a place that has been incredibly influential and will hope to continue to be, and he understood that. I think it has to do with Cuba's actual geographical position. So it was always an important stepping stone for different imperial designs. And it also became one of the wealthiest islands after the Haitian Revolution because it took over the sugar industry once the Haitian Revolution abolished slavery. That slavery was continued in Cuba and it became the biggest sugar producer. So there was always wealth throughout the 19th century, and that wealth also meant institutions. So it was this kind of double-edged sword of like the most horrific slavery at the same time that there was this great investment on the part of Spain in the island. So I think that set a history of a kind of institutions. In terms of its world historical importance in the 20th century, it became a model for Latin America, the Cuban Revolution in the early years, and then beyond, obviously, Latin America, Asia, and Africa. Even into the Angolan War, Cuba sent I think, I'm not sure about the number, but I think it's 200,000 troops to the Angolan Wars.
I think we just celebrated the 20th anniversary or 25th anniversary of that Cuito Cuernavaca battle.
So I think that has a lot to do with its world historical importance. Also, one another point that was made today in the speech by Obama, who made sure to invite Cuban doctors into the salon where he was speaking, was the role of Cuban doctors in international missions.
Turning to your book, the I was struck, despite my politics, I guess I incorporated a lot of conventional American attitudes towards the island, that it was sort of sealed off from the outside world, and cultural expression was perhaps somewhat constrained by that. But what you portray is a world of artists and writers who are very much aware of global trends, very much incorporating styles and genres that, you know, the most advanced arts and writing in the world. How did these relations with the outside get carried on? How did Cubans engage with what was going on elsewhere?
Well, there's different moments. So one of the most important moments in Cuban art history happened in the 1980s. It's a generation associated with an art show that was called Volume 1, Volumen Uno. And those artists had different access to international contacts, including the important figure of Ana Mendieta, who was a Cuban-American artist who went back to Cuba in those years and sort of introduced Cubans and American artists to one another. So she played an important role. But at the same time, Cubans also had access to magazines, to international art fairs. The beginning of the biennial, I think it was 1984, the Havana Biennial, which was an important gesture towards creating a different kind of biennial that was not the Venice Biennial model. But then after the 1990s, Cuban artists also began circulating more. You know, they've been going to residencies in China, in Europe, in the United States. And there have been international figures who go to the Cuban art schools. So that's one way this exchange has happened.
The first couple of chapters of your book about the use of plant metaphors. Mm-hmm. First, we're sick of the rhizome, and the importance of the tree. The tree is rather important to the Cuban imagination, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I was sort of surprised to find, but when you think about it, it makes sense given the long history of sugar on the island. So there's always been this tension between sugar and deforestation and trees and sort of a kind of counter-imaginary to sugar. One thing I mentioned in the book was, in my research, I found this fascinating journal from the 1930s called Cúspide, which was an arts and culture, but also politics journal that was really dedicated to reforestation and to non-sugar environments. And the most interesting aspect of it, or one of them, besides the fact that it was accompanied by major reforestation programs, was that it was also published from within a sugar mill. So the person who directed the magazine was also the manager for four sugar mills. So there's always been this tension between sugar and other environments.
But he wasn't taking the company line.
No, no. But at the same time, he was running those four mills.
The forest had to be cleared to make way for the sugar, right? And that Cubans seemed very aware of ecological effects of that. You know, I think it seems Americans don't really think about that sort of thing very much, but it seemed, from at least from reading your book, that it was very much in the minds of Cubans, going back decades, what the ecological impact of this transformation was.
Yes, I think so.
But then there's that that shrub, which
mm-hmm. is Marabu.
Marabu, yes. What's that like?
Well, you know, it's something that I hadn't been aware of myself until I came across it in art, and then I saw it everywhere. So marabu is a non-native species that was introduced into the island in the 19th century. And it was always a bit of a struggle for farmers who were trying to keep their fields clear of it. But it really became an invasive problem in the post-Soviet period. On the one hand, because petroleum was used to some degree to eradicate the roots, and petroleum sort of disappeared for a while with the end of the Soviet Union. It was a major supplier for Cuba. But also because the sugar industry has been almost entirely closed in the last 10 years. So fields that had been dedicated to sugar have now been overrun with marabu. So it's become more of a visible presence and a metaphorical presence for artists.
Yeah, what's the metaphor about?
The metaphor actually varies. So in several works that I found, the metaphor was, or the symbol of marabu, was an example of sort of failed agricultural policies, or else either the omnipresence of the state or the failure of the state to actually realize a kind of functioning agricultural sector. But I look at one work by two artists. One is Cuban-American, one is Cuban, but based now in Miami. And their work was actually imagining Marabu as a much more protean example of, on the one hand, digital aesthetics, the way things are multiplied, the way that Marabu shows up in the background unwittingly of some digital news shows, but also as an example of invasive economic systems, kind of global capitalism on the island.
This was a post-Soviet phenomenon, the proliferation of the Marabu metaphor?
Yes. I mean, I only saw it in the last few years myself, uh-huh. sort of 2005 onwards, uh-huh. which so probably has more to do with the end of the sugar industry.
Yeah, so the Cubans now have shut down sugar, or pretty close to it?
For the most part, yeah.
And why is that? It was a big earner of money, wasn't it?
It was a big earner of money through the 1980s. At some point, the Brazilians eclipsed the Cubans in terms of both sugar and ethanol production. I don't know exactly the true reasons for the closure of the sugar industry. I know when Fidel Castro spoke of closing it, he mentioned its nefarious roots in slavery. But I think it may have had more to do with the changing investments on the part of the government towards a service economy.
I'm speaking with Rachel Price, author of Planet Cuba from Verso.
So what did that, at the end of the Soviet subsidy era, had an enormous influence on the economy. It went from a relative golden age to great deprivation. How was that reflected in changes in artistic interests?
Well, that whole period following the fall of the Soviet Union is known as the special period in Cuba, the special period in times of peace, as opposed to a wartime special period. And it was just marked by incredible scarcity. In terms of art and literature, it's something that I was actually moving beyond in this book, because it really produced, on the one hand, a looking outwards, because Cuba was suddenly not part of this Soviet system, but at the same time, it was really, I would say, a looking inwards towards the peculiarities of this strange post-Soviet movement. So you got a lot of attention to groups that hadn't been given space before, groups whose sort of subcultures, right, that didn't have any attention before. That was a real obsession on the part of literature, for example. There was an attention to the strange kind of inventiveness that Cubans had to resort to in order to survive the scarcity. And so it became a very kind of particular vision of Cuba. And I think now we're seeing something that's much more global in its taste and in its concerns.
Yeah, well, that, I guess, was in some sense a period of an isolation. But now Cuba is being exposed to global capital. Mm-hmm. What's that doing to the artistic consciousness?
Well, I mean, just a reminder that Cuba actually opened to foreign direct investment around 1991. So what's recent is U.S. interest in capital. But, you know, Europe and anywhere else has always been able to do that since 1991. What is the recent change with the U.S. normalization doing to art and literature? Coincidence or not, we have seen in the last 5 years a whole spate of new independent galleries that didn't used to exist. There's the first international gallery, which has opened a building in Havana, which has no precedent so far until this past November, I think it was. There's a lot more circulation, a lot more curators and gallerists going to Cuba. There's more Cubans being shown in galleries here in New York, for example. So there just seems to be more circulation in general.
What are the economics of these galleries going back, you know, to earlier times? Were they part of the foreign exchange economy or domestic thing? Or how is it all financed?
Since the so-called special period, artists were a special group that were able to travel when other people had to ask for permission to leave the island. They always circulated more, and they were able to earn in dollars, paying taxes to the Cuban government, but they were able to sell in other currencies. And now a lot of those economic hurdles have been removed for, in general, not just for artists. Cuba has a long tradition of a kind of art scene that's not about the market. And so a lot of these more independent galleries have as their goal, not necessarily a market, or not necessarily selling so much as exhibiting different works.
You said there's a distinction during the classical period of Cuban socialism between professional artists and amateurs, right? There was professionals had a certain status as workers that amateurs didn't. What did that mean for the artistic life?
Well, artists were asked to join the Union of Artists and Writers.
Sort of curious about the career path of an artist. So what?
Cuba has a very strong sort of feeder system. So people who show artistic talent or interest are encouraged to go to different art schools, and they pass through different systems in the provinces and then sort of the best artists end up going to the Superior Art Institute.
And the state has encouraged this all along?
Yes, the state has always been very encouraging, very supportive of the arts, very promoting of the arts.
And what about content? Were they like looking for some kind of crude socialist realism, or are they more adventurous than that?
There was a brief moment of socialist realism in the 1970s, which is known as the Gray Period, the Gray 5-year period, which some people say was 15 years. But the arts have always had more space, more leniency, but there's also always been censorship and self-censorship. So you see it all.
With the self-censorship, what were people afraid of? Were they afraid of prison or isolation or what?
I think it's always been a range. I mean, there's, afraid of isolation, but also of prison.
The second half of your book, you write a bit about these rather striking dystopian science fiction mm-hmm. novels and stories, and some art as well. It seems that Cuba is gradually entering a capitalist world that looks to be falling apart,
right.
With recurrent economic and especially ecological crisis. And this weighs very heavily on the consciousness of Cuban artists, right? Yeah, tell us about some of these. The Underwater Havana.
Uh-huh. Havana Underwater is a novel by Eric Mota, which was published last year. You know, Cuban science fiction has always drawn both on the U.S. and the Soviet traditions of science fiction. So they're very familiar with the different kinds of dystopias that have been presented throughout the 20th century. And this is a novel that it's quite humorous, and it imagines a future Havana that's half underwater because of global climate change. And there's also sort of no more states. There's no more U.S.
Yeah, the U.S. is a total wreck.
The U.S. is a wreck. Cuba is warring fiefdoms connected to petroleum platforms. The Vatican has been privatized. It's really kind of a...
You know, parenthetically, there's finding oil has been one of the great hopes of Cuba, right?
Right.
Economically speaking,
yeah.
But then...
Throughout the 20th century.
The meaning of oil then is frightening.
Well, you know, I just think one of my arguments in the book is about the kind of getting past this division between a Cuban perspective and a global perspective and understanding that Cubans are part of the global conversation, which means that they can care about climate change or not in the same way that people can be convinced, be...
A country that has contributed almost nothing to a problem.
Right.
So what happens in this underwater Havana?
So in the underwater Havana, Afro-Cuban religion has been melded with the internet. So the Orishas live in the internet and guide evil and positive quests for different special powers and so on. It's very much inspired by video game culture as well. I know the author himself is a hacker and a video game aficionado, so I think that really informs it.
How are they fixed for hardware?
How are they fixed for hardware?
Yeah.
Well, in the novel, it's a real gamut from the most primitive to the most advanced technologies, which in a way is a kind of comedic commentary on the way that Cubans themselves, under very hard conditions, have managed to make incredible inventions. I once was working in Cuba and my Mac power cord broke and I thought, what am I going to do? And I went to the version of the Cuban eBay, Revolico, and an hour later there was somebody at my apartment with the missing part. So there's this kind of...
Well, they've kept all those American cars going for 50 years, right?
Right.
Now Google is coming in with internet now, right?
Yes. So I just saw this recently, today actually, that Google is installing a very speedy internet in the art space that the artist Cacho has established. So he set up a space in a sort of a poor neighborhood in which he already has made available free internet. It's a little bit off the beaten path. And now Google's going in there. I think the studio is going to be called Cacho and Google.
Just like Bushwick, where the artists are leading the gentrification. And then there's a novel about a highway, right? The Autopista.
Yes, this is a young author who I think is really interesting, Jorge Enrique Laje. That novel, The Highway, the movie is the title, was from 2014. He since has even a newer novel sort of about that takes place in the post-normalization period. But The Highway, the novel, is a kind of cyberpunk novel, like a lot of his work, that the premise is just that we're with a ragtag group of people as they make a documentary about the making of a highway. And this highway, it clearly takes place in Cuba, or it's being built in Cuba, but it extends far beyond Cuba into the Atlantic. the Galapagos Islands has been paved over. Again, this is a future dystopian world. There's climate change, increasing hurricanes. And you encounter a lot of historical figures along the way, from Chinese premiers to people who testified in the hearings about Guantanamo and so on.
Oh, then there's, you have an image in the book of Obama on a piece of American currency with Chinese writing on it.
Yes.
This is part of this dystopic melding of things that are falling apart.
Well, I'm not even sure it's necessarily dystopic so much as it is a kind of just realist examination of the forces that are driving the world today.
Well, this country that was nominally socialist for 50 years and had many accomplishments and many disappointments, now it's really been opening up to the world of capital for the last 20 years, and certainly now the U.S. involvement is going to accelerate that. Mm-hmm. What do people think? I mean, what's their attitude towards the socialist-capitalist conflict now?
Well, first of all, my own feeling would be that it hasn't been socialist for a long time, and that there's very little of any kind of welfare state there right now. So I think most people are basically interested in being able to have functioning careers, functioning businesses. I think there's a lot of excitement about some kind of change. There's also apprehension.
But then all the dystopia about climate change,
right,
and disaster, that's the doing of the capitalists. So how do they evaluate that?
I think there's like a really complex attitude towards the history that Cuba itself has lived through the last 50 years. There's so much disillusion, anger, frustration with Cuba's own government that I don't think artists and writers are necessarily interested in endorsing the way that their own government has framed this kind of standoff. I think they're really interested in finding their own relationship to history and to political economy. So, for example, you can get anti-capitalist groups within Cuba, like Observatorio Crítico, which is a group that says, we want more socialism. What we have here is not socialism. Then you have groups that want full market economy. I think there's really a desire for something other than the current government. At the same time, I think we're seeing a reformist moment where people also really just want changes in their welfare. I don't think they're interested in regime change or per se. They just want, to be able to have businesses, to be able to not have to emigrate.
But at the same time, there's a huge and growing gap between rich and poor.
Yes, and I think that's something people are very afraid about. They're seeing it intensify in the last few years, and they're worried about what these new economic reforms and changes might do to exaggerate that.
And then, so what does the arrival of the American president contribute to that feeling?
Well, I'm actually going there tomorrow, so I'm very interested to see how it's being received there. I think that there's been a lot of maybe even too much hope and optimism invested in the visit by Obama. Despite this long history of U.S. imperialism and presence in the region, I think there's a kind of investment in the potential for change that Obama could represent. So, something you might not expect, given that history.
I think a lot of Americans thought that in 2008, too.
Exactly.
Somewhat disappointed.
Yeah.
All right, thanks a lot.
Sure.
That was Rachel Price, author of Planet Cuba from Verso. Her day job is as an associate professor in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese Languages and Cultures at Princeton. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of 1980s power pop from the Primitives, perhaps in the ludic spirit of contemporary Cuban artists. Till next week, bye.
Watch your